There's a whole lot of things I want to tell you about. Adventures, dangerous and queer. Some you could guess, and some I've only hinted at. So please lend me your ear.
Everyone has a relationship with gender. What's your story? Hello and welcome to Gender Stories with your host, Dr. Alex Yantafi.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Gender Stories. And I, as ever, I know I'm always excited, but I really am excited to be talking today with Professor K. Allison Hummer, who is Assistant Professor and Coordinator of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies of Southern Illinois University, as well as having published a book that I think just came out yesterday, actually, October 17th, Masculinity in Transition, which I'm very excited to be talking with Allison about. They've also published extensively in academic journals ranging from disability studies, trans studies, gender studies, masculinities, and have a forthcoming book chapter on book banning, so many things that we could talk about. We're even going to talk about the Barbie movie, little spoiler for you listeners or those of you who watch on YouTube. So welcome, Allison. Thank you for making time for this podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited. I love the show and I'm just thrilled to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. It always makes me miss academia a little bit when I talk to other scholars, but then I talk to colleagues and I remember what life in academia is like, and it's short-lived.
Yeah, it's just such a thrill to be sort of outside of that frame too, to just be able to have a conversation where we can put my ideas like into a different frame and talk like real humans.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm excited about that too. So yeah. I really want to talk about your book, Masculinity in Transition. But first of all, let's talk about masculinity studies. I remember that, you know, the emergence of masculinity studies, you know, a very long time ago, I used to teach in what used to be women's studies, actually, at the time. That's what my doctor is in. And I remember people having actually pretty conflicting feelings in some ways around the field masculinity studies as it emerged. And so for the listeners who don't know what that is, what is the field of masculinity studies?
Yeah, I think it really emerged like out of some of the men's movement activity in the 70s. So that's some of the root systems, like where men were trying to sort of like reclaim their masculinity, but also like kind of critique it, but not really. And a lot of it was in the white cishet framework. And so a lot of that field also developed differently from like masculinity and queer theory. Mm-hmm. So we have Eve Sedgwick coming out talking about masculinity. We have sort of Jack Halberstam coming out talking about masculinity, but those two fields really developed pretty separately from one another. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a move recently, and, you know, one of my scholar mentors has been very active in trying to change the direction of the field, trying to make it more comparative, trying to make it more inclusive of diverse masculinities. And so I think there are changes, but I think it's very stubborn to move out of that frame, and to have also some interplay between the study of trans and queer masculinities and white cishet masculinities. So that's a little bit of the basics of where the field has been. But I think, like I said, it's moving in a really different direction.
It really is. I mean, even compared to, say, oh my God, how long ago did I start doing my PhD? 30 years ago, almost, you know, when I was initially in women's studies, I feel like a lot of the critique was that, like, are actually men truly engaging in deconstructing masculinity, or is this just a way to perpetuate a lot of this kind of similar systems, right, of oppression? And one of the things I love about your book is that it does really bring into conversation, you know, trans studies with masculinity studies, queer studies. It addresses capitalism. It addresses kind of, you know, how we cannot talk about gender without talking about race, right? It's a beautiful intersectional book, I think.
Thank you.
So what kind of moved you to kind of write this book, right? There are so many things that we can focus on in our studies.
I also wanted to show it.
Oh, yes.
Because it just came yesterday. And I think the spine like really resonates very nicely with this kind of media slider here. Mm-hmm. I love this feature that they added to it. So this is the real live object.
I love it.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. I think that, you know, my initial interest in masculinity came out of female masculinity and sort of my own doorway into thinking of my own relationship to masculinity, which, you know, my coming out story is very long, but starts kind of late in life and took many twists and turns. But my initial coming out as a lesbian really took place through female masculinity, through Jack mm-hmm. Halberstam's work, which that book just changed my life. I mean, at the time when I read it, I really didn't know what it meant for me. And it took a while to kind of see where it would go. And then, you know, when I came out as a lesbian, I was in a straight marriage and then came out as a lesbian. And that had many twists and turns as well. And then, you know, came out as non-binary around 2018. And, you know, for me, who, you know, I'm 49, so that word was not present at all. Mm-hmm. Like, there was no understanding of non-binary. Like, no. I think, like, kids today have such a wonderful, rich vocabulary mm-hmm. for talking about gender and sexuality that I didn't have. And so coming out as non-binary also dovetailed with things happening with Me Too in the culture and what happened around Me Too and toxic masculinity being such a topic. I mean, people were sending me articles about masculinity all the time, but in a lot of ways, it was kind of a redux of what we see in masculinity studies. A lot mm-hmm. of it was about white men and how they could do better. Right. Like I remember Anna Sales on Death, Sex, Money podcast coming out with an episode called Manhood Now, where she interviewed all of these men about like, well, what have you learned, you know, to do differently? And it was kind of, you know, very shallow. You know, it doesn't really get to, you know, the critique of white supremacy or the critique of heteropatriarchy. But one thing I thought about is, well, why aren't queer and trans masculinities considered part of masculinity studies?
Yes.
Like, why are they separated out so much? And one thing that happened that really transformed me was a class that I taught on critical masculinity studies. And it was right at that 2018 moment where Brett Kavanaugh was being confirmed mm-hmm. and we watched those confirmation hearings together. And it was just kind of, you know, the word patriarchy started to be used again, which had been really retired.
Absolutely.
It was too blunt.
Yes, I didn't hear that word in a long time. And all of a sudden it was everywhere on social media. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the class, though, was really interesting because they were all different kinds of people. You know, there were Black men, there were trans mm-hmm. men, there were non-binary folks, Black women, white women, international students. It was almost mm-hmm. like everyone wanted to talk about this. And I think it became really important for me to situate it within the culture itself and not off in some side territory of queer and transness, but to really put it into conversation of like, what do queer and trans masculinities offer? They offer quite a lot, I would say, for undoing normative, toxic masculinity. And so that was it came out of that moment, really, the direction of the book took off from there.
I love that. And you mentioned toxic masculinity. So for our listeners who maybe don't know what that means, how would you define toxic masculinity, or how would you describe the idea of toxic masculinity?
Right. That's a really good question. You know, I really critique the term in my book because mm-hmm. one of the things that happened out of Me Too is that it became about, you know, putting on trial various bad apples mm-hmm. and those were the toxic ones, or it was really the extreme ones who were toxic. When I really think it's about looking at, you know, the more daily kinds of violences that toxic masculinity, you know, is all about. And for me, it came down to really three areas. So I talk about normative masculinity instead of toxic for that reason, because I think that Toxic really pushed us in a direction of thinking about Trump quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of Jeffrey Epstein, of, mm-hmm. you know, these men that we can also talk about what actually changed for Me Too, which I think is a really important thing to consider. And we can talk about it in light of the Barbie movie or whatever, but like, yeah. you know, I think that the tendency there was to want to incarcerate too. And that yes. was the solution. Was incarcerate and then we'll be rid of it. But that's not how toxic masculinity works. Like if you think of the term toxic, it spreads.
Exactly. It's like yeah. a poison, right? It's like something toxic in the air. I often describe like, you know, cisgenderism or transphobia, like the air we breathe, right? It gets into our lungs, into our body minds, and we just reproduce it without even thinking about it. And so that toxicity that's in the air from normative.
I love that. The idea that you breathe it in even.
You do. You breathe it in. To me, that's how it feels, right? The words, the culture, the songs, the movies, the intergenerational familial patterns. I mean, I'm passionate about it. I wrote a whole book called Gender Trauma, about this idea that it's part of that kind of ongoing settler colonial project. And I love that you highlighted the normativity aspect, right? Because in a way, I really feel that this idea that, well, it's just those men over here who are doing the harm. And if we get rid of them or if we imprison them, then everybody else will be okay, is a very colonial white supremacist idea, right? It's an all or nothing, good or bad, perpetrators and victims, all these binaries, something that I'm also not a big fan of, obviously, in every way. And I think that's one of the things I love about your book, that you challenge some of those binaries. You know, when we really look at kind of toxic masculinity, it's not about imprisoning a few men or a few bad apples or teaching boys to do better. It's really questioning the whole system of masculinity, right?
Exactly. Like that was one of the main sort of takeaways from that whole moment. And it really, in my opinion, and I could be wrong, but in my opinion, it really faded also mm-hmm. until maybe yes. Barbie. I mean, maybe the Barbie movement is like a resurgence of Me Too.
That is
possible.
I love that idea because you're right. In that moment, and that Me Too moment was so intense in so many ways. I know that for me and a lot of other folks, so many survivors is like, it's a lot, right? It was also a lot because it was everywhere. The trauma was everywhere. People were sharing stories everywhere. I know I had a lot of clients also were like, this is a lot because it's everywhere. And so I'm constantly exposed and constantly rethinking also about the trauma. And then you're right, it seems to also almost have resettled into more fascism, right? More fascism, more yeah. white supremacy, more, promotion of violence, systemic violence, like through police brutality, like the building of Cop City and all of that. And yeah. so, mm-hmm. yes, I don't know. I do want to shift into talking about now, but I wonder what you've noticed in that moment, you mm-hmm. know, that kind of rise and fall. And do you feel in some ways what we saw was also pushback, right? Okay, now you've had this moment, but we're done. Now things are back to normal, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately is how the response from cis men was mm-hmm. sort of ranged from guilty to defensive to rageful.
Yes.
And so these online cultures of grievance were mm-hmm. building and building. And, you know, I don't talk about this explicitly in my book, but I think it's possible that it built even toward the January 6th coup attempt, you know. Because a lot of what these paramilitary groups want is they want women to return to the home. They want to return to the traditional 99% of the time white families. Mm-hmm. Like they want a return to sort of women focused on having children and having babies and taking care of their every need. And I think that there was a simultaneous sort of escalation of these cultures of rage. At the same time that we see a really powerful movement of people, you know, not just cis women, like many people, as you said, sharing their stories, yes. coming forward, you know. But I'm wondering also if people felt like they were heard, you know, like I think that's yeah. one of the issues there is did people feel heard? And then where did that go from there? Like, did it just sort of get repressed on the larger scale again? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the men who were guilty about it, like there's a wonderful book by Jane Ward called The Tragedy of Heterosexuality, where she tracks how, you know, it was a rebranding, right, for yeah. masculinity.
Absolutely.
And it changed from sort of the art of seduction to the art of personal transformation. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like now, like I still have people sending me articles about like men's groups who are trying to like, you know, express their emotions together, like in a sort of secluded woodsy environment. And it's sort of like, you know, that was part of the men's movement of the 70s as well.
Yes.
And every time it sort of goes back to not a sort of deconstruction, but a reclamation of masculinity, you know?
And a reclamation that's often so inappropriate in so many ways, because it's often cis white men also appropriating kind of cultural traditions like sweat lodges in the 70s and 80s, you know, or like talking sticks or like connecting with like animal spirits. And it's really like what sometimes when I look at some of this information, I'm like, okay, as a therapist, yay, people are connecting with one another and themselves, but this is so toxic and problematic on so many other levels.
Know.
You know what I mean? It's like,
I know.
Yeah.
Particularly the sweat lodge idea. And someone just sent me an article like a few weeks ago about another men's group that engages in these similar kinds of things, you know? And the whiteness aspect, like I said,
yes.
it's predominantly white men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think regardless of the intentions, like I think that anytime a group of cis men get together, it's usually not good.
Yeah.
And like and in large numbers.
Absolutely. I mean, you
that's
know,
a fraternity right there.
That is a fraternity right there. And it's like so problematic in how men can also bolster each other to justify violence, right? Or to justify harassment or to justify just that, yes, the normative masculinity that is so hard for them to let go of, because why let go of power, right? When you can rebrand it. Yeah. And
right. And mm-hmm. the culture sort of supports it in all these ways and politics
yes.
supports it. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that, you know, the sense of loss that my students felt after the overturn of Roe versus Wade, like, you know, they called me with such grief because I think that they felt the sense of failure, you know, that like I said, only a few years prior, I think there was a moment of like, we're going to address this finally. Like,
yes.
we're going to address the issue of sexual domination and sexual assault. Like, we're going to change things, you know, and there were flaws, many, many flaws within it, as there are flaws within every social mm-hmm. movement, every feminist movement. And I take that and I understand that. But I do think that around the topic, like I said, with this class, it was like people were really wanting to have intense discourse about it across all these different investments in masculinity, all these different kinds of investments in masculinity. And I don't know, I haven't taught that class in a while. And I don't know if there would still be that same fervor around it. And I think that's because there is so much loss post Roe, and now with this just insane assault on trans people, trans yeah. and non-binary people, like, you know, so we have BLM and then, yeah. you know, it's just, I think we're all feeling, you know, not the royal we, but I think we're like, there's a sense of just collective grief right now and not knowing what comes next is what I'm sensing.
Absolutely, which makes sense because it's this kind of pooling, you know, on one end, we have this kind of rise of fascism again. And at the same time, we also have this tension pooling towards justice, right? whether it's abolitionism, whether it is, you know, reproductive rights, whether it is body autonomy rights for everyone, including trans folks, we're really seeing this kind of moment of tension and uncertainty. And I think there is a lot of grief, a lot of fear, and often out of fear, there's also extreme reactions, which I think we're seeing in the world right now. And in the middle of all of this, there's also popular culture that keeps making things, right? So let's go there. Let's talk about the Barbie movie, because I think in a way, I was really pleasantly surprised, you know, and I have to say, as somebody who has a more queer masculinity, who really enjoyed dressing my Barbies and doing musical theater, I would have definitely been
on me music, too.
Right.
Oh,
I was totally. Just like, right. Oh, yeah. I was into Barbies growing up. And,
yeah, me
you
too.
Know, I really wanted a Barbie camper more than anything when I was like 6 or 7 years old, right? Like the little plasticky one. So I was both excited and fearing the Barbie movie, because at the same time, then when I became a parent, I was very anti-Barbie, right? Because at that point, I was like, I was a feminist and very queer. And I was like, Barbie is not a realistic representation of womanhood. I remember, you know, with my kid, who's now actually a young adult and knows I tell the stories, you know, we're in the middle of the co-op doing grocery shopping, and she had this Barbie that her, of course, her queer uncles gave her a whole set of Barbie Disney princesses just to see my face on her birthday, you know, and I was saying right. something about Barbie, and she goes, I know this is not what real women looks like, but it's my doll and it's okay. And I was like, yes, honey, it is okay. It is also just a doll that you can play with, but it's more than that, right? And so the Barbie movie that came out, and it was so different than I think many people expected. What did you think about it?
Definitely. I mean, I felt very seen like throughout that movie. And I also really love Barbie. What's funny is that my parents wouldn't get me any of the dream house or the car, or the spa. I used to have to go to my friend's house, and she had an attic where she had all of it laid out. Oh. It was just, and I used to make my Barbies like houses out of shoe boxes.
Same.
You know, and I would color them and stuff like that, because my parents didn't want to, they would allow I only had one Ken, which is kind of funny. I always ask people like, how many Kens did you have though? I just had the one, and he was just sort of, I don't know, drove people around. It was like the chauffeur.
I don't think I had any Kens when I think about it. It was all Barbies. So
I just had one, and he didn't get much attention, which is funny, because that's kind of, you know, because Greta Gerwig is so interested in talking about girlhood. I mean, we have Lady Bird, which is such a fantastic film. But I think that there's so many things to talk about with the movie, but like Gloria's relationship, like Gloria, the woman who, you know, is the one having the sad feelings, and she has to go repair the space-time continuum by going, like Barbie has to go back to, you know, to help Gloria to heal and help the relationship with her daughter to heal. Like, you know, Gloria has a line where she's like, you know, if it's this hard, you know, for you as a doll, like just representing a woman, like, what does that say about what it's really like to be a woman? I'm not quoting the line exactly. And I think that, you know, we can talk about how Barbie has been like, you know, potentially destructive for little girls, but I think at the same time, or, you know, gay men also have a total thing for Barbie, and like a lot of different cultures embrace Barbie, but is it embracing the ideal, or is it embracing some kind of high femness? That is maybe, I love the trans critiques of Barbie that say this is like a trans movie as well.
Yes.
Like the whole idea of it as being trans. But, you know, I think that with, you know, with the Barbie movie, like there were just some moments, like we were speaking a little bit about this, like, you know, when they go into the real world, right? And Barbie is suddenly a sexualized object where she wasn't in Barbie land. And the commentary that I think Greta's making there about what it was like to play with Barbies, you know, in your childhood bedroom, you know, or in my friend's attic. And it was such an imaginative space of like feminine empowerment, really.
Yes.
that I, as a non-binary person, like I don't, like I'm very much seeing my gender in the most complex way possible, right? So, and that's part of what I talk about in the book too, is not shutting off like any part of myself, like, you know, and I think that's a very difficult space to be in some ways. So I very much think that the femininity aspect of the movie and really centering the feminine, you know, I can't think of another recent film that has done that, you know?
Exactly. And I think, you know, thinking about also like what femininity represents and how complex right. the relationship with femininity can be, you know, and having brought up, you know, my oldest was a girl who's had to do her own journey around femininity, right? Because this, what does it mean to love femininity, to love pink, and also to be incredibly smart and to love math and to love science, you know, and almost to have this dilemma, you can be one or the other, right? You can be pretty and pink, or you can be smart, but not pretty and pink, right? But if you're pretty and pink and smart, then the world cannot tolerate that, right? And in a way, a lot of her pushback right. was like, femininity is okay. Femininity is not the problem. Barbie is not the problem. The patriarchy is the problem. I'm like, you're right. The exactly. patriarchy is the problem. The doll is not the problem. The patriarchy is the problem. Yes.
Right. And we've really, like, thanks to queer theory, like, we've really moved away from that feminist moment where it wasn't okay to wear, like, heels if you want yes. to, or, you know, to have that highest femme aesthetic. Because one of the things that I really push on in my book is it's not about aesthetics.
Yes.
This is about settler colonialism, white supremacy, and, you know, and violence against marginalized people. Like, and that, I think there's so much room to play with gender. And I think Barbie invites us into that, honestly, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the fact that the tween character, whose name I'm forgetting just now, like the fact that she has that speech also, you know, and she's so yes. angry, mm-hmm. but then she's able to heal that anger like through Barbie is such a sort of cross-identifying moment it really, in the queer sense, you know.
there's so many queer moments. I think that actually the Barbie movie is so queer, which is why the conservative media was so upset about it. I think at one point there's even like the colors of the trans flag during, I think it's during the Man I Am number. I need to watch it again to make
yeah,
sure.
I know it is.
But,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, you watch it more recently. And I was like,
I watched it,
what
yeah.
is even happening right now? This is the gayest thing I've seen in a long time in a mainstream movie, actually. And so there's this moment that is, just the movie is so trans, it's so queer, but it's also really a highlighting of just how messed up kind of white masculinity in America is. You know, in a way, Ken, like
well,
the men,
yes.
Ken, it's really about this crisis of like white men in America, right? In some ways, like.
Well, I picked up on something that I had missed. I've watched it mm-hmm. twice now. Probably will watch it again later today. I'm inspired. But when Ken takes over Barbie land and goes and learns about patriarchy
yes.
and horses
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
takes the books out of the school library.
Yes.
And I mean, all of those moments are great, like where he asks to be a doctor, but he has no credentials. And he's like, but I'm a man. Like, and then
yes.
when he has that commentary with that executive where he's like, you're not doing patriarchy then very well if you can't just do whatever you want as a man and you need all these degrees. And he's like, oh, no, we're doing it very well. We're just hiding it better.
Yes.
Like, it's just, it's perfect. Like, that
it
was
is perfect.
That was exactly what I was saying about the post-Me Too moment, is that, you know, things just become folded back in instead of really radically restructured. It just sort of gets folded back in. But there's a moment. So when Ken and, you know, I guess the Kens, but I think really Ken is the ringleader there. The primary Ken is the Ken leader, waves a flag that mm-hmm. is just remarkably similar to a January 6th, scene.
Yes.
And the takeover is a violent one. And the takeover is, we're going to turn everything into a saloon, basically, which I have a chapter on the Western in my book. So I really appreciated that. Like, for me, like the Western has been like such a fun part of my book, because there are new Westerns that have come out that have really mm-hmm. revised the genre. So I look at Westworld and Godless as being like, you know, redefining it around that Me Too moment too.
Yes.
Like Godless came out in 2017, just like a couple of months after it was kind of anticipating it, I feel. But anyway, so the January 6th moment is in there. And I feel like there's a lot going on in the subconscious of the film too, that was fun. And I laughed and I laugh with my students, but you're also really like hit at a deep level with what our current moment is like. You know, that we haven't reclaimed Barbie land.
We have not reclaimed Barbie land. And I cried a lot during the movie too. I was surprised by how deeply it hit me as somebody in my 50s who has gone through, I feel, many gender iterations in five decades. Yeah. And you know, there are so many moments in the movie that are very, like, I would say, funny and gut-wrenching at the same time. And I, you know, I really love when you said we haven't reclaimed Barbie land. And I know that there's been also, I've seen some commentary on social media. I didn't like the ending. It should be both Barbie and Ken now ruled together. And I was like, that what? Why? No. And so I think it's also very interesting to see how people are reacting to it and going, well, but, you know, Barbie should be like caring, right? And now Barbie and Ken's, you know, both Barbies and Kens should be equal, right? This ideal of like equality, which doesn't really actually undermines the structure, the foundations, right? And so I'm wondering about how you felt about the kind of the reclaiming of Barbie land from the Dojo Casa House setup.
Yeah, right. I think that one of the things that I've stressed, like in all of my work, has been that fundamentally, when we talk about transphobia, we talk about homophobia, we talk about, it's all misogyny.
It is all misogyny.
Like at the root of it is misogyny. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that there's probably a feeling of fear. Like, what if we let the feminine, you know, out of the box? Like, what if we let the feminine rule? Like, I think there's a fear there, not only for, you know, people who identify as, who are assigned male, but also everyone sort of like having this fear of like, we need this sort of patriarchal control to organize our lives. Like, it'll be chaos, like this sort of feeling. And that's, again, one of those feelings, as you talked about before, that sort of seeps in and it's the air we breathe. That is anti-feminine, right? So I personally really loved the fact that Ken is looking kind of dejected in his Kenuff sweatshirt at the end. And, you know, the thing about it, too, that I picked up on the second time is that Ken has no emotion in that scene.
Yes.
So did he really love Barbie? Or was it just an accessory to his ego? Like, it's clear that it was an accessory to his ego and that the whole thing was about that in certain respects. Like the last scene that they have where Ken doesn't know who he is apart from Barbie, but it's really the ego identification. It's the fact that Barbie is this sort of accessory in his narcissism, a projection, you know what I mean?
Oh, and absolutely.
So, so I think that I was very happy with the fact that Ken was left behind in Barbie land to continue his job of beach indefinitely.
I agree. I feel like I was like, no, why? Ken is not ready to rule. Like, Ken has to go through his own process of like unfolding, undoing, finding himself, you know, because this, and that's what I love as well, that, you know, actually, the Barbie movie highlights men are not okay. And that type of love is not love. It's self-centeredness. It is narcissism. It's self-centeredness. It's the, there is no space for Barbie's well-being or Barbie's happiness, right? It's about me, me, me. You're not paying attention to me. You're not giving me what I want, right? And therefore, because you're not giving me what I want, now I take everything. Right. And that is not love. And yet we see that play out in, you know, reality TV and dating shows. We see it play out and like, you know, right. Exactly. That could be a whole other episode, I'm pretty sure, talking about.
I love that genre.
Me too. I've just finished watching the latest season of Love is Blind. And I'm like, sis, that people are not okay.
That one in particular.
Right?
Totally.
Maybe we'll have to do a take two of like, let's talk about gender in reality TV shows and what's happening there.
But I was watching these shows way back. I mean, I started with Love Connection.
Yes.
I used to watch Love Connection. And before I even knew what a date was, because my parents let me watch whatever I wanted on TV. TV was my surrogate family, if you will. So I'm very into pop culture because I had that kind of close relationship with characters too, mm-hmm. where they became like, you know, I think there is a term for that, but that I'm forgetting, but where you develop a relationship with people on television or in film.
Mm-hmm. Like a parasocial type of relationship.
Parasocial, that's the term. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love popular culture as well. And I think that's one of the, you know, many reasons that I loved your book is that you do kind of talk about popular culture as well. And just how kind of masculinity plays out, not just kind of the political stage or the, but also like the popular culture stage, so to speak, and that fragility of normative masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the whole idea of like a Hollywood movie can be a real source of, you know, the term that I use in the book is unruly alliance, like bonding with people who are different from you. And one of the things I really loved about going to see the Barbie movie was that I was surrounded by such a diverse group of people. And again, it reminded me of those classes that I talked about where like, there are really a lot of people that are interested in this movie. But every once in a while, you would see like a dad with his young assigned female mm-hmm. child on his phone, like not paying attention. And I kind of wanted to nudge him and be like, you know, you really should be looking at this.
Because it's going to be some questions, if nothing else.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
And there should be questions, right? Even with my youngest, who's a boy, and he came into my life when I was a little older, like 7 years old. And just a couple of years ago, we had this conversation around masculinity, right? It was like, you know, well, I know that often it's like cis white men that do those things. And what does it mean that I am one? And I'm like, that's a great question to ask yourself, right? And we had this great conversation about the connection with like, you know, white supremacy and masculinity and all those things. And it's not about, there is nothing, you know, it's not bad to be a boy. It's just you have to be aware of why, you know, and this discourses. And I remember he was so angry and he went, why are they not teaching me this in school? You know, that was his middle schooler reaction was, why are they not teaching me this in school? And I was like, you're right. Why are they not teaching you this in school? Please go ask your teachers. I will also ask your teachers why they're not teaching you this in school. Right. But it's this idea that often a lot of this discourse is so easily relegated to academic journals or academic books. I mean, I love your book. And also it is a dense read, I think, for the general public, potentially, I would say, you know, not too dense, but definitely there's like a level of challenge, you know, that is kind of beyond, I don't know, middle schooler level as it should be. Yeah. And so I love that. Like, how do we bridge this divide, so to speak, the conversations that are happening in like queer studies and masculinity studies and, you know, and then there's the Barbie movie that I think in some ways is bridging some of those conversations. How do we do this? How do we bring those conversations more into an educational context, an everyday context?
I mean, that's a great question. Like considering, you know, back to, I think you said it was your son, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your son. Like back to your son's story, like I have those moments all the time lately, retroactively, where I think, why didn't I learn this in school? And why didn't I learn that in school? And like the fact that right now education is being attacked. You know, I just moved from Tennessee, you know, very red state, to Illinois. And, you know, I got gender-affirming care in Tennessee, and it was terrifying because just as I was getting that gender-affirming care, you know, you have the senator of Tennessee coming out and saying that the clinic that I went to is mutilating children. And then the whole thing just really broke open. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about also is that I loved, loved, loved the graphic novel Gender Queer by Maya Kobabe. Yeah. And so I taught that book in a trans studies class back in 2018. This is sort of addressing your question of like what kinds of books and materials I think do bridge that gap.
Yes.
And how I would also like to do more popular writing once I get tenure. Obviously, once I get tenure. So, you know, so that graphic novel was something that I taught, and I was just literally floored and shocked that book is now the most banned book in the country. Yeah. And that it wasn't a politicized move for me to teach that book in 2018. And my students loved it. And more than anything else, it really told my story, you know, from a much different generational viewpoint, mm-hmm. but still. And now, like now I'm in a blue state in a very interesting location in Southern Illinois that's becoming like a place for trans refugees mm-hmm. who are fleeing red states, reproductive justice. Like, we're just surrounded in a lot of ways. And mm-hmm. so for me, those kinds of, you know, graphic novels, like the popular culture that I talk about in the book, like, you know, I talk about the poet performer Andrea Gibson, mm-hmm. non-binary poet performer, who, like, you know, I have moments in the book that I'm hoping people will grab onto who are not super high-end academic, and I try to sort of balance that out, because I think that there are so many things that should be more widely available to people too. And the shutting down of that is intellectual abuse in my mind. And so, yeah. So yeah, I don't really know where I'm going with that.
That's okay. I mean, honestly, we can just go to this place of grief, even that not only like, I think that, you know, I remember when, Donald Trump, the first time, you know, said they were gonna run for election, and everybody was like, oh, you know, it was almost like it was a joke. And I was like, oh, here we go. Like, this is just the next chapter in the rise of fascism, right? And people are like, you're exaggerating. It's because you're like, you're coming from Italy and you see fascism everywhere. And I was like, and then, you know, not long after, people are like, oh, fascism. I'm like, yep. I don't know, maybe I am hypervigilant because I was brought up with, you know, teachers and grandparents that talked about, you know, having survived fascism. But where was I going with this? My ADHD brain will come around in a moment again. But and if it doesn't, we'll just have to cut this bit, and that's okay. And if we don't cut it, listeners get to see the process, but you know. Go for it.
No, I think fascism, you know, I do talk about this quite a bit in my book that, you know, American fascism has always been with us, the seeds of it, you know, in enslavement, the seeds of it in genocide of American Indians, Native Americans, you know, internal, you know, the incarceration of Black and brown folks predominantly, just accelerating, you know, in the latter part of the 20th century, like, all of that is fascism.
Yes, thank you. That is exactly where my brain was going.
We're just seeing it now with the gloves off.
Exactly. And I think that literally seeing books banned, it's hard to deny it, right? I was like, literally the parallels are all there, right? Going after trans folks, you know, pre-World War II Berlin, book banning, you know, I mean, really, it's not even subtext anymore. It's like the text is all there in terms of just this kind of incredible push towards like this anti-intellectualism, this fear mm-hmm. of knowledge, this fear of books, mm-hmm. right? This mm-hmm. fear of critical race theory, you know, this fear of gender ideology, right? To use all those terms that are kind of mm-hmm. so pervasive. And and while I understand on one hand that it stems from fear, uncertainty, living under late stage capitalism, it is also, I think, scary and horrifying for a lot of minoritized communities for lots of good reasons. And so I'm wondering how you You know, I know you bring that into the book, right? Like how we cannot talk about masculinity without talking about race. We cannot talk about masculinity without talking about racial capitalism, actually, specifically, right? And the political stage. And so, yes, I'm wondering, like, if you want to say a little bit more about those connections that you make in the book.
Yeah. So one of the things that I really wanted to do was to make a book that celebrated resistance. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to make a book that was a dreary description of the present, although I do quite a bit of that. Like what I really wanted to talk about was how, you know, the word of the word sort of exuberant masculinity or joyful masculinity through a queer and trans lens comes into mind, but that these are all valid and wonderful and colorful and, you know, vibrant masculinities that are queer and trans that have something to show us about what masculinity really can be. Like if we associate it with like phallic sexuality and power and assertion or, you know, whatever you associate it with, and that sort of like yang dimension of things can be used like productively towards social justice goals, towards giving us pleasure as well, sort of giving folks pleasure. And that's one of the things that I think is important too, is sort of the pleasures of masculinity, just like the pleasures of femininity can be available to all kinds of different people. So like I talk about performance art and I talk about like using sex toys and performance art, you know, as a way to sort of challenge like this like so-called biological supremacy of assigned masculinity. You know, I bring in, you know, like I mentioned the Westerns already, but I also talk about unions. Like I talk about a book that people really have loved and loved and loved with it, which is Leslie Feinberg's Stonebridge Blues. And I had the really special experience of talking with Minnie Bruce Pratt, Feinberg, late Leslie Feinberg's partner who recently passed away. And I was so glad that I had that opportunity because she just said, Leslie would have loved your read of this book because I approach it as about work and I approach it from the perspective of, you know, the butches banding together, you know, to protect one another, you know, on the factory floors, for example. So I address sort of unions and that's such a hot topic right now, of course, that we have all these strikes happening. But this is another thing that I feel like I almost like anticipated because at the time I was like, well, there was some Amazon stuff going on and there's stuff going on with Chipotle. And there, you know, there were little things happening here and there, but it's massively exploded from where it was. I mean, it's not at a mass point, but I think it's just such a dramatic increase in union activity and people being pissed about capitalism, quite honestly.
Absolutely. People are tired. Like, we're going through, I would say we're still going through a pandemic, even though everybody's pretending we're not, right? We're still going through a pandemic. People are still dying, you know, and people are like, why is everybody so tired, so dysregulated? All our executive functioning is kind of gone to hell in a handbasket or whatever the expression is, right? And people are like, so confusing. I'm like, is it confusing though? Or is it like that we're all so exhausted by late stage capitalism and people no longer want to just, you know, use their body minds as commodities just on the altar of capitalism and to make more money for Jeff Bezos or whoever has way more money than God, right? And one of the things I love about your book is that it's not just about, you know, I would say the trauma of normative masculinity, but it's also the potential expansiveness of, you know, relationality of care, right? And we're seeing that really emerging, like the idea of mutual aid. It's almost mainstream.
It is talk about mainstream.
Mutual aid to people who are not like anarchists or something, that they understand the concept, right? And it's like, it's amazing to me. And so let's go there. Let's talk about some ways the medicine, the healing is probably in community, in that relationality, in that mutual care.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about back to toxic masculinity. You know, it's about independence and ruggedness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, John Wayne, I know this is an old icon that maybe a lot of listeners won't know who he is, but I still see his picture on supermarket magazines and such like that. Like, mm-hmm. it still has quite a cult following, like independence, autonomy. And also, you know, if I see an enemy, which is normally an American Indian or Native American person, I have the mm-hmm. right to kill that person.
Yep.
Right. Same with other marginalized groups mm-hmm. by race. And so, you know, I feel like, you know, that kind of toxic masculinity needs to be countered, you know. And again, it's not so much about aesthetics or style. It's much more about, we need to start caring for one another.
Yeah.
Like, we need to get out of this crisis of empathy that we're in, you know. Mm-hmm. We need to, on the daily, like on an individual level, but also when it comes to across identity groups, like, you know, the Combahee River Collective statement, the Black feminist statement back in the 1970s was like, you know, yeah. I have to fight for my own oppression, but also like link up with other groups that are oppressed, because we're not going to be able to do this alone. Like, yeah. and that is what has really come to the fore for me, is we have, you know, the complete rollback, you might even say decimation of reproductive justice, reproductive mm-hmm. rights. We have trans people suffering in ways that just breaks my heart daily, you know, and we still, you know, post BLM have, you know, just vicious forms of violence against,
Absolutely.
You know, Black, Indigenous and people of color in the United States. So I think that if we, it's a tendency right now, I think, to kind of circle the wagons and sort mm-hmm. of get with your people. And I understand that and I value that. And I think that's important. But I think it's also looking at how all of these struggles are connected, and trying to be, you know, be of service to the other, because it's the other relationship that we even talked about in the Barbie movement. It's like yes. movie. It's like, you know, the using of the other as an object, mm-hmm. you know, from Ken's perspective, as a way of ego formation.
Yes.
Like, yeah, that's what he uses Barbie for, right? Like, you know, the idea of increasing our capacity to be empathic, to be empathetic toward one another mm-hmm. is one of the goals of my book. And it's also seeing the ways in which queer and trans community just offers so much to the mainstream too. Like, you know, as I mentioned before, like not wanting to see these kinds of masculinities, which includes, like I said, a wide range of folks, mm-hmm. Gay men, butches, yeah. cis femmes. I mean, lots yeah. of different trans women, like trans mm-hmm. women's masculinities, which I yeah. think is, I'm hoping someone writes a paper on that. I think that would be really great. Probably I will. But like, you know, like seeing it as relevant to the broader discussion of masculinity, yes. you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, I was brought up very much by second wave feminists, but luckily I also found Black feminists very early on, right? And so this idea that really our roots of our oppression are connected. You know, we all have skin in the game when we work for each other's liberation, which has definitely been one of the tenets of my life, not just my work, right? Our struggles are interwoven. Our struggles are connected. We can't, because we are interdependent. We're part of the same ecosystem, right? And often when I talk about gender liberation, I often say, this is not about doing away with gender or masculinity or femininity. This is about expansiveness. This is about like actually a more expansive masculinity, more expansive femininity, more expansive non-binariness, or just, you know, agenderness, or whatever we want to call it, right? It's more expansiveness rather than more constriction. And that's one of the things that I love about your book, is that there is expansiveness. There is like a breathing towards the future through relationality, through care, through empathy, which in a way, of course, is the antidote, because colonialism, you know, misogyny, they're all very constricting systems, mm-hmm. right? They're all they make things smaller rather than more spacious and more expansive and more free, at least in my mind. I don't know. Sorry,
I just went on a little tangent. I love thinking about that. No, I love thinking about the idea of capitalism as a constrictor, constrictor of our bodies, a constrictor of our souls, a constrictor of our time too. Like a lot of the thing one thing I think about recently is how capitalism structures our time.
Yes.
You know, so that we feel we're completely out of rhythm with the natural world.
Exactly.
You know, we're very fixed in that way. Or let's just say that the culture encourages that almost as also as a badge of honor. Like, you know, like you were saying, people are resisting that in the workplace, but it's sort of like, well, how much work can you handle? Then that's your badge of honor. And I'm actually, you know, my partner is not from the United States, and a lot of it's extra here.
It's really extra here. I've had many people say, oh, you take European amounts of time off. And I was like, I sure do. And I intend to keep doing that now that I have the privilege to work for myself and do that, because why would you want to work 50 weeks a year if you don't have to, right? I mean, obviously, a lot of people have to survive under not only capitalism, but also like in a country where there is no universal healthcare, where there's, you know, some states don't even have education that's really up to par because that's not where the state is investing. So I understand why people work so hard. But what always strikes me is the people use it as a badge of honor. And I think that does take us back to that masculinity, right? That macho-ness that like, but, you know, isn't it great that I have the flu and I'm working? I'm like, no, you're making everybody sick and you should be resting. It's really not a sign of strength to me, but okay.
Well, and that's, you know, it's such a parody of itself in a lot of ways, like that kind of white class privilege masculinity, just to add that in there as well. That's important.
Absolutely.
And you know, I think that what the Barbie, back to Barbie, just really briefly
absolutely.
But like, I think what Barbie might encourage people to do is, you know, when they happen to be sitting with a white cishet dude who's playing the guitar at them for 4 hours, maybe they might like look at them, look at that situation, say, wait a minute, this looks familiar, because my students and I laugh so much again at that scene because it hits home. It hits home.
Absolutely. Those stereotypes do not come from nowhere. I definitely had some very painful flashbacks to my teenage years, you know, during the movie going, oh, you know, because I think that's my teenage years, maybe my early 20s, where there was still some of those interactions with this man. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up one point that I wanted to go back to was being raised by a second wave feminist, I think you mentioned, but like finding your way to women of color feminism and Black feminist practice. And like, I think that one of the things that happened for me, like coming up really in the early third wave, was that there was still this sense that to be masculine was bad.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And so for me, that led to a lot of repression and still a lot of confusion. And I think one of the things that I wanted to do with this book was to work through, like, you know, my father was abusive. My brother was abusive. Like, you know, I have this abuse history also. And it just happened. I'm white. And so it's kind of like, well, what does it mean to move toward white masculinity?
Yeah.
Is there something in here that can be dislodged from that meaning, like that set of meanings? And I think it's still something that I struggle with, because when I came out as non-binary, a lot of my lesbian friends were not so happy with that. And I had to sort of demonstrate that I wasn't going over to the enemy side, you know? And I think that's where we need to separate, like, you know, not being dominating in that sense by any means, but still having that playfulness with all things masculine. Like, I can wear a tie, or I can, like, you know, I can play around with it. And I think I try to make that distinction in the book, is that there's a difference between like playing with masculinity and using it, its creative potential. Right. If one wishes to do so, but anyone can use it. Right. But that style doesn't equal domination, and style doesn't, you know what I'm saying? Yeah,
absolutely. Because also when we demonize something, right, in a way, second wave feminism kind of demonized masculinity in a lot of ways. Like I really struggled with, I didn't understand my gender identity for a long time because I thought it was internalized misogyny. And so I really tried to embrace femininity. I used to say that I felt like I was in drag, which I was, turns out, because I didn't know about my gender yet, right? But I was, you know, and then you try to embrace femininity, but you can't embrace it too much also if you're queer, because then that gives you a proximity to masculinity, right? I remember even as a bi person, when I was still femme presenting, right? Inherently suspicious because of the femininity and then the bisexuality that gave me proximity, right? To cis men. And it's, that doesn't
we have
solve
very
anything.
Similar stories. We have very similar stories because I came out, like I said, I came out as lesbian, then non-binary. Mm-hmm. But the piece I left out earlier is that I then came out as bi plus or pan, like either one of those terms really suits me. And it was just a really interesting trajectory because I was looking for my masculinity sort of the whole time. And like you said about being in drag, like, you know, when I look back at pictures of myself from those years, there's just, it does feel very strange, you know, and that I was always trying to reach towards something that wasn't, that didn't fit me. Or I was always like, okay, this is how you do nails. Okay. What do I do again? Like, and it's always just a little off and like, you know, the prom dress was off and, you know, I just didn't, again, generationally speaking, there were very limited options. Like one could be a butch, but I was like, but I don't ride a motorcycle. I'm not good with tools.
I'm not good with tools. That's the way. And I'm like too much of a princess, and too much of a gay masculinity to really embrace butchness. So it was complicated.
Right. And that's why, like, butchness, I did a lot of work on butch in my early academic career. And I was, you know, finding all these ways to talk about butch outside of that stereotype. I mean, for a lot of people, that is really an important part of their identity.
Absolutely.
And I honor that completely. It just never fit me. And I think that's where finding queer theory and finding, like, you know, Eve Sedgwick's whole idea of cross identification, like the idea that, you know, she as like a cis white woman identified more with gay masculinity was for me an opening that I so badly needed. And I also identify more with a gay queer masculinity. And like my neighbor who's a gay man, and I always talk about like he wants my outfit ideas. And like, I love it, you know, and it's like, that's such the richness and the fluidity of queerness that like I just thrive on. And I want everyone to have that ability, you know, and I want everyone to be able to play with these things and to not also be in fear. But I have to tell you that when I had, you know, top surgery, I lost some lesbian friendships over it. And that was really, really difficult because, again, it was at that high point. We're still in the high point. I mean, we just keep going higher. There's no when we were at a new high point for the time period anyway, like I felt really abandoned. And I think it sort of prevented me from moving in that direction for a while because I was worried in a certain way of losing my community, of losing people's love. I mean, I lost a couple of friends. I mean, it wasn't like a mass sort of shunning, but I did again have to demonstrate that I wasn't going to be, people made assumptions I was going to use he, him pronouns, which was really interesting.
Which, and even if you chose to, like, that wouldn't justify losing friendships potentially, but I totally hear you because it's like when I started dating one of my partners of now 23 years, I lost most of my lesbian friends because they were all like, see, right? Always suspect. We knew it. Like, right. And it's like most of them, it was just like, peace out. Right. Because it was still pretty much lesbian separatist world in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so those are the fractures and the cracks. And I've also met so many folks who were like lesbian identified and then fell in love with a man and married and totally moved out of queer community. You know, I was very stubborn and hanging there. And I was lucky because I also had a lot of queer men, male friends, which right. was great because most of them were like, oh, when I transitioned, they were like, finally, this makes sense. Right? It's like, oh, you're kind of a queer dude. Like, this mm-hmm. makes more sense.
Oh, my God. Totally. Yeah, no, and there, no, just to backtrack on that, no, there would be nothing wrong if I wanted to take up he, him yeah. pronouns whatsoever. It's just more that when I said I'm going to get top surgery, people would confront me and say, are you going by he, him pronouns yeah. now? And it was almost like a test.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, are you going to go by he, him now? Because now we need to know where you stand.
Exactly.
It's mm-hmm. not antiquated, these battles. They're very much happening in real time. For a lot of us. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's where my concept, to be honest with you, of Unruly Alliance came from.
Yeah.
Because I had to reinvented myself many times, and it's all come with its own community issues. You know what I mean? Like, leaving behind the straight world was a horror for me because mm-hmm. it led to family courts, it led to discrimination, yeah. it led to all sorts of things, right? That I don't want to go into too much detail about, but it led to horrible places in that way. And then joining a lesbian community, you know, I still felt a little bit like, well, I don't know if this feels like me, you mm-hmm. know? And then like coming out as non-binary and having some trans friends also say like, I don't get non-binary. Like, yeah. it's just, I wish that we could maybe soften all those edges and just allow everyone to be who they are. And I know that maybe sounds like a naive thing to say, but I just really wish that there weren't these sort of hard lines sometimes. And that's mm-hmm. not at all to generalize all queer community mm-hmm. or all queer trans community. It's just more to say like, there are these moments, right? And a lot of it revolves around masculinity, or at least for me, it has, you know,
absolutely.
For me it
has. Mm-hmm. I love this idea of softening the edges, right? Because I often think about, well, where is the hard line, right? And as somebody who's been a hardcore abolitionist of like geopolitical yeah. borders, as well as the police, right? Where are those hard lines to me feel so colonial and not relational in every way, right? Because where does trans end and cis begin? Where does non-binary end? But, you know, it's almost like life isn't binary, which obviously
I love that book. Yeah. I
thank
don't know
you.
I love that book.
I'm one of the co-authors.
So. No, I know. I love that. I love that book. I've taught that book also.
Oh, thank
oh,
you.
Yeah.
Allison. I didn't know.
Yeah.
But it's like, I'm with you, right? For me, I feel like my life work is like, how do we soften and blare those boundaries so that all of us can just breathe a little freer, be in deeper relationship to each other, like, because otherwise we can't, right? If there are those hard lines and hard walls between us, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think the Unruly Alliance concept, like idea for me, which I think you get the spirit of, you know, is like in my previous university, like, you know, my best friend was, you know, much older than me. Like she was, you know, she retired and I left that university around the same time, mm-hmm. but she was such an ally for me and like, you know, totally of different generations, also identified as bi plus, but like, it was a very unlikely pairing, yeah. you know, that we would find such solace in each other where I mm-hmm. didn't always find it in other spaces. And so I think yeah. for me, I've had very unlikely friendships, alliances with people that have changed me. And I think mm-hmm. if I weren't open to that and I only wanted to be around people who looked like me, I would have really lost out on so mm-hmm. much. Like I learned about masculinity even through my 90-year-old stepfather who just mm-hmm. passed away recently, actually. And so he taught me a lot and sort of taught me that, you know, there is such a thing as a non-abusive father too. Like there, yeah. it is possible to change masculinity. And I think that's what you said earlier too about the fact that it doesn't work. It's an old feminist adage, like patriarchy yeah. doesn't work for anyone, right?
Exactly.
That it doesn't work for white cishet men either. And some have realized that. And I think my class did that for some of these men as well. Mm-hmm. And they really started to question, you know, not their style, none of that, but like started to question how they relate to others, because that is,
sadly,
that is the point. That is really it. Like, how do I reach the other and how do I empathize with another's experience? Because so much of what our society teaches us is, who am I as an individual? Here I am on my phone. How many likes do I have? Like,
yes.
How am I being perceived? And the social media is a double-edged sword there, because I think social media has done incredible things for queer and trans community, incredible things for folks to build solidarity. But of course, also there's the other side of it, which increases our narcissistic impulses for all of us. And that needs to be sort of disidentified with or resisted, you know, where we need to look at that critically as well and think, like, you know, it's about how am I using that tool, not like shunning it or getting rid of our phones, because that wouldn't be useful.
That's not gonna work.
And I would really
exactly.
miss my phone, to be honest with you. I really love my phone. So it's sort of like, you know.
I would miss my phone. I don't know that I would miss emails sometimes. I do miss the days before emails. But I have to say, I love social media. It's so much easier to find community, right? It's like, you know, I didn't know any trans people that were out growing up, right? I'm sure there were some around me in Italy in the 70s, but I didn't know them. And so, like, social media is really giving, like, such a playground to younger generations to find themselves, to see themselves, even if they're in an isolated rural area, they don't have to feel like I'm the only kid who feels like this in the whole world, right? Because I can find somebody else who resonates with that experience. And I think that's beautiful, you know, like, I think that much as there is like this shadow side of social media, I think there's still so much goodness in the internet in terms of relationality.
Oh, yeah.
But,
oh,
yeah.
Definitely. Like, and I think like the ways that my students learn on social media and then come into my classes and they have such, they identify themselves with such precision.
Yes.
In a way that I really envy, because I think about like when I was around in the sixth grade, when it was time to take off my like tomboy clothes,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, again, it was still a really gay tomboyness. Barbie was still there.
I love that. I was like, I think that's a beautiful place to end on, the gay tomboyness. I feel like I could have like 20 different conversations with you about all the things that we've been talking about. I want to be respectful of your time, and maybe we'll just have to have at least another episode on reality
TV.
That
would be great.
And gender.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was like, let's get on the calendar for 2024, please. I'm for it. But anything else that you were hoping to touch on or talk about that I haven't really asked you about? I always ask my guests at the end, like, is there anything that we have not talked about that you are hoping to convey or communicate to the listeners?
I just really want to reiterate a message of hope, you know, and really just leave space for how many people, you know, we touched on grief, we touched on grieving, we touched on trauma, and just how many people are really in a state of suffering right now in the United States, because that's where we are right now, and just feeling isolated, like just to know that they're not alone and that, mm-hmm. you know, there is community out there and there are different ways of being masculine and that, you know, that is available to us now and we can seize on that and we can, you know, live in the beautiful vibrancy of all the different masculinities that are possible, you know?
I love that. And that now all I have in my mind is that man I am seeing in Barbie with the beautiful, vibrant masculinities. What a beautiful place to end on.
Right.
And you also have a book out. So just a reminder for our listeners that your book, Masculinity in Transition, is out now, and they can order it from wherever they get books, in either an electronic book format or an actual hard copy of the book. And it has a beautiful cover. If you want to flash it,
I'll show it again.
The folks
yes.
on YouTube, again, it is there a beautiful is. Cover.
Yeah, I think they did a wonderful job.
Yep. They really did. There's some purples, yep. there's some blues, there's some oranges, there's mm-hmm. some classical imageries with some social yeah. media imagery. I love it. So please get Allison's book. It's really brilliant, and it's a wonderful read. And I'm looking forward as well to your chapter on book banning as well. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. if people wanted to find out more about your work, where should they go on the internet?
KAllisonHammer.com is my website. And I post new stuff on there, new publications. There's also more information about me as an artist, scholar, cultural critic. I do lots of other work in literary journals and literary magazines and things like that. So I post new things on there, and you can learn a little bit more about me there as well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for this time today. I really appreciated our conversation, and I'm really looking forward to our next one already.
It's wonderful to get to know you, Alex. Thank you so much for having me.
Likewise. And Gender Stories listeners, as always, thank you for supporting the show, for listening. Don't hesitate to reach out and let me know how you feel the season is going. I know I had a little bit of a pause in 2021, but it's wonderful to be back and to see that you're all still listening. And so let me know what you'd like to hear in 2024 as well for next season. And until next time, take care of yourself and embrace your beautiful masculinity, whatever that means to you.